Welcome to another episode of Congo Kids Life Stories, where I share my experiences of growing up in the Congo in Central Africa. My hope is you find knowledge, entertainment, information, and insight of another culture and a new perspective of the Congolese people and Africa. For 6 years now, I've been telling stories of my growing up in the Congo using this podcast medium. As a missionary kid, my experiences are unique and full of stories worth sharing. The previous 38 podcast episodes have been a labor of love for my children and grandchildren to hear about spending my youth in Central Africa. I've shared fun episodes about food, hunting, truck trips, the music, and the exotic pets we had, for example. I've also shared more somber topics, such as a six-part series on the difficult history of the country, the Rwanda genocide refugee camps, and a five-part series about the pain and issues of being sent away to a boarding school. My parents joined the Evangelical Free Church Mission in 1964 and served in Congo until 1990, then were reassigned until their retirement. They served a total of 40 years with the mission. Thus, my formative years in Congo shaped me considerably and are important to me and my family, who devoted 25 years to the Congo mission effort. We sacrificed to live in Congo, but compared to many missionaries in Congo, especially those who served in their early years, our experience was much different. Many early missionaries paid with their life or the death of a loved one. Yet, they persevered through the loss to bring the gospel to the Congolese. The end result is a thriving church organization, hundreds of thousands of believers, and having made a huge impact for God's kingdom. As my family and I were a part of this effort, I feel it is important to tell the story of our mission work in Congo. This podcast series will share the journey, pain, loss, adventures, and victories of the missionaries over a 100-year period, starting at the beginning of the work through the present. The mission organization was the Evangelical Free Church denomination that focused on the Ubangi region in the northwest corner of what is now known as Democratic Republic of Congo. For some background, the Free Church movement was birthed by revivals rooted in Puritan pietist traditions from the late 1700s. In 1884, 22 churches, comprised mainly by Swedish immigrants with similar beliefs of church government and biblical doctrines, agreed to cooperate to support home and foreign missions. By the early 1900s, there was a Bible Institute and a statement of faith was developed. By 1920, they'd opened China and Venezuela as their two foreign mission fields, with a few missionaries serving. A few years later, they expanded to Congo. The goal of the mission effort was to share the gospel to the Congolese, start churches, educate and train up leaders to continue with the work of the church autonomously. The Free Church mission faced considerable challenges in its infancy. To set the stage, the start of the mission work in Congo included governmental red tape, challenges with the heat and climate, slow communications, health issues, lack of medical care, and lack of doctors, resulting in many missionaries or their children succumbing to sickness and disease. Identifying property for new mission stations, securing the land, clearing said land, constructing buildings, including homes, schools, hospitals, and churches, was a long and tough journey, especially in the 1920s and 1930s. Communications were extremely slow between the field and the states. Construction materials were hard to come by and transport, and travel was very slow. In the early years, just getting to the field involved taking a ship from New York to Antwerp, Belgium, then another ship to Matadi, the river port on the Atlantic Ocean, by Congo. Next was a one-day trip on a wood-burning train from Matadi to Leopoldville, the capital. This was followed by a 10 to 14-day trip by river steamer to Lisala on the Congo River. From there, an almost 200-mile journey remained to get to Karawa or Tandala, the two original mission stations. One walked, rode a bike, or in many cases were carried in a jungle sedan chair, involving four men carrying a person in a chair supported by long poles on their shoulders. It often took 3 to 4 months to get from the U.S. to the field. Traveling in Congo in the early years between villages or mission stations before cars or trucks often was by bicycle or on foot, taking days. Everything was slow and took time. Time that now we don't have, nor would have the patience for. While now, a truck or motorcycle can make a trip in 4 hours that would have taken multiple days. Or now, an airplane can make the same trip in less than an hour. Our mission's direct involvement in DR Congo started in the early 1920s when it was a colony called the Belgian Congo. This continued past independence in 1960, several coup d'etats and challenging political issues and economic changes and woes until the late 1990s. The missionaries evacuated repeatedly during this period. First, in 1960 at independence. Next, in 1964 when the rebellion was in process. Then, in 1991 when the president was close to being ousted. And finally, in 1997 when the civil war broke out and Laurent Kabila overthrew Mobutu. This is when the mission model that had been in place for over 70 years ended, essentially for good. Since that time, the baton has fully passed to the local church, with our mission providing only minor assistance and support. As any successful missions organization will state, working oneself out of a job is the ultimate goal. To leave an autonomous church body to carry on the work that the mission introduced many years prior. This series will explain how the pioneers persevered with considerable headwinds and share the triumphs and losses during the process. The Free Church Mission effort was then joined by the Evangelical Covenant Church Mission in the 1930s, and we worked side by side and in some aspects in concert in the Ubangi region. As the mission work became established, additional mission stations were added to cover a wider area. The pioneering missionaries tried to establish them about 90 to 100 miles apart. As one station would become established, another was identified. Then the hard work of procuring the land from the government, clearing the land to build the homes, schools, hospitals, churches, and other facilities to round out the mission station campus happened. This series will also provide a spotlight of each mission station, telling the story of each one's procurement, construction, and focus ministry. I interviewed people that lived at each station to share an overview of the property, the improvements, its ministry, and their memories. I trust this will give the listener a better flavor of the unique aspects of that particular station. Furthermore, numerous missionaries sacrificed with their life or they lost their children due to disease or illness while serving God in this rugged assignment of opening a new mission field in Congo. So besides the historical timeline that you will hear, I will also tell about those that died in the process. A total of 20 adults and children died in furtherance of the mission work in Congo. Many others had to leave the field due to health reasons, never to return, and pivoting their life trajectory as well. There is a story behind every person that succumbed on the mission field, and I want to tell those stories based on written documentation and from people that knew them before they went on to their heavenly reward. I want to preserve this history. Furthermore, each death impacted the family and their ministry tremendously. You will hear from those left behind to deal with the loss and how they move forward with that grief. These people, adults and children alike, are martyrs, saints, if you will, that gave the ultimate sacrifice to bring Christ to the Congolese. This podcast series is an attempt to tell both the story of our mission work and honor those that died on the mission field, never to return to their homeland of the United States. There are so many books and articles and materials that I was able to read and research in preparation of this series. I must commend several of the early missionaries to the field that kept detailed logs, documented their lives, the events that occurred with the mission work, or their personal lives. Several folks wrote books upon retiring. These documents painted an excellent picture of what it was like in those early years and preserved this most important history. Delving into the lives of the early missionaries to read their stories and imagine myself alongside them was fascinating. So while there is a mountain of archive material with thousands of pages, hundreds of stories, experiences, and perspectives, I've done my best to provide a general overview of the history of the mission work. There is a lot of information I'm sharing, and considerable history is going to be shared that has never been heard or documented, and this series will preserve it for future generations. This series will have 7 parts to it. This is episode 1, and it will start the journey and explain the vision and discuss the man who had the vision and got the work started. The time period will be 1920 to 1935. Episode 2 will continue the story from 1936 to 1947, when the mission's growth had reached 6 mission stations. Episode 3 is a story about the period from 1947 to 1952, when the mission work expanded tremendously with the opening of multiple mission stations. The fourth episode covers the period of 1953 to 1962, where the main aspects of this period include Congo's independence and the subsequent evacuation of the missionaries and the turmoil following the next few years. Episode 5 will take the listener from 1963 to 1972 and will focus on the issues of the Simba Rebellion and the coup d'etat, and then the nationalization of everything by the government. Episode 6 covers the period 1973 to 1997, and the final years in summary will be Episode 7. As mentioned, my family was part of the Congo mission effort from 1964 through 1990. I spent my formative years there, as well as 1 year as an adult while in college. So in this series, you will hear some of my memories of places and events and the impact these events had on me. There is so much to tell, so let's get started with this series titled Trials and Triumphs in Congo, a 100-year mission journey. This series is about the history of the establishment of the Evangelical Free Church mission work in the northwest corner of Congo in the Ubangi region.
And how can anyone preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. Romans 10:15.
Our mission work started in the early 1920s, over 100 years ago, in the Equateur province in the Ubangi region of the Belgian Congo. It was called the Forgotten Corner due to being very remote from other areas of commerce and colonization. Belgium had taken over from King Leopold II, who'd exploited the people since 1885, decimating them through butchery, killing, pillaging, amputation, and fear to get ivory and rubber revenues for himself. In 1908, he finally relinquished control of the Congo Free State, and the area became a colony called the Belgian Congo. The Belgians brought education, industrialization, roads, taxation, agriculture, mining, exporting, and infrastructure to Congo and the Congolese. But the northwest corner was relatively untouched and influenced by the Belgians due to its lack of natural resources and the challenge to get there. The person that started our mission work was Titus Johnson. A book was written about him by Sigurd F. Westberg and Francis J. Mason in the early 1970s, which was a compilation of his daily journals, thousands of letters, and hours of taped interviews. The book is titled Deep Tracks in Africa, and much of the historical information about Titus Johnson's life journey was gleaned from this book. As I recount the stories of our mission's very early years and you hear of the travels, perseverance, and hard work by Titus Johnson, you will concur that when the Africans describe him, they will say that he did indeed leave very deep tracks on the continent of Africa. He was a visionary, a man of extreme adventure, always wanting to push forward, and lived an amazing life, as you will soon hear about as I share his direct and then indirect impact on the mission's infancy and growth through maturity, spanning 50-plus years of his adult life. It was in 1912 that a young Swedish boy, the youngest of 12, named Titus Johnson, left his home in Sweden at age 15 to emigrate to the United States. He'd read the book Uncle Tom's Cabin and was deeply moved by it and wanted to give his life for helping black people. His father had started a church and preached in nearby towns, traveling long distances and against resistance by locals. Titus saw this, and no doubt his father's example impacted him greatly for his tenacity in his life. Small for his age, he topped out at 5'5" when he reached adulthood, but he was strong and stocky. He made it to Stockholm, and then a few years later, a friend helped him move to New York. He was 17. He worked many jobs. One was scrubbing floors and washing dishes in a hospital. He then dreamed of becoming a medical missionary. The seed was planted. In 1916, he moved on to Chicago. It was there that he attended Moody Bible Institute and was moved by a missionary speaker from the Africa Inland Mission, known by the acronym AIM, noting,
"There was not one missionary in over 1,000 miles in Central Africa, and the need was for 1,000 missionaries."
It was Christmas 1917 that he proposed to a young lady named Bertha Peterson. Then, in July 1918, he approached the Overseas Mission Board of the Evangelical Free Church, where he was attending, and asked to go to Africa. Unfortunately, they didn't have a mission there, nor plans to open one. However, they said that if he joined the Africa Inland Mission, there was a chance that in the future, they could work out a cooperative deal. So he applied with AIM and was accepted. He struggled to get financial support by traveling and speaking at numerous churches in the Midwest. Then, in 1920, he left for Africa, with his fiancée to follow, to Northeast Congo. New York to Europe, to Egypt, down the Nile, and across the desert, then a long truck drive, then a 14-day walk. He finally arrived at Blutkwa, his temporary assignment, learning the language and the culture. Bertha was a day's journey away at Linga, and she too struggled with the language. The romance continued, and the mission agreed to allow them to marry before their 1 year on the field had elapsed per mission policy. However, Bertha fell ill, and many helped during her sickness. As Titus shares from his journal,
"One time she cried out,
'I am better.'
But she burned with fever.
'Pray Jesus to take me home,'
she urged Titus. Then she rallied to say,
'No, I want to stay and be salvation to these people and a blessing to you.'
But the end was nearing.
She took my hand as she said,
'Now I leave everything in the hand of Jesus. Amen.'
Then her face lighted up and she tried to sing. She said slowly,
'Goodbye.'
And a little later went to sleep like a child in its mother's arms."
Her three-week battle with bacillary dysentery was over. It was May 15, 1921. Titus and Dr. Trout made a coffin that night out of bamboo slats secured by vines. Mrs. Trout prepared the body, lined the coffin with muslin, and added flowers. At her service, Titus shared,
"She had a great heart full of love, and she threw herself into the work, forgetting her own comfort and safety. She visited the villages to learn the language and bring help to some. She gathered a crowd of children around her. She poured out the needs of her heart before God. She was overjoyed to be here as her master's messenger. She was happy when there were only native potatoes for food, happy when the grass roof leaked, happy to rest on a camp cot."
She was laid to rest the next morning. Thus, the work for our new mission hadn't even started, and the first saint had perished and was now in glory. Rest in peace, Bertha Peterson.
Precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalms 116:15.
Titus Johnson's fiancée was gone. His view of his work and mission was certainly changed. Back home in the U.S., the news of Bertha's passing stirred interest and empathy for young Titus and his desire to open a mission work in Northwest Congo. Many were moved to write cards and letters. It is important to recognize that in the time of pre-colonial rule, the slave trade had been in full force, and as such, the natives didn't trust the white man. Even though slavery wasn't an issue anymore, it was still fresh in the minds of the Congolese. Furthermore, the Belgians treated the Congolese as second class, with few rights, basically like animals. White men were regarded as ravagers and murderers. So while Titus felt that learning the language was key to building trust and communication, the cultural wedges from slavery, exploitation, and poor treatment were still too much to overcome. Inroads with the Congolese were difficult to achieve. But what about treating the sick? He felt that perhaps healing and teaching would help build bridges of understanding and acceptance. So he appealed again to the Free Church Mission to approve him. However, due to it being months before his letter was received, and then for the committee to convene and then respond, almost an entire year elapsed. Impatient to start the work he felt he must do, in February 1922, he resigned from the Africa Inland Mission. He then had no job, no money, and no church support. His salary had only been about $300 per year, and he began counting out the few dollars to his name to finance his journey. He figured he needed about $400 total. All he had was a dream of starting a work in the Ubangi region of Congo. God had called him, so it was up to God to supply the means. And did he deliver? Several days later, the mail arrived, a huge sack. A few days later, another sack of mail, letters, cards, and checks. In total, $800 had been given to him, twice what he needed. Thus, on July 10, 1922, he left Blutkwa for a journey that would take him all over the continent, eventually ending at Karawa in the Ubangi region of Congo. He had porters to carry the supplies. The maps were lousy or incomplete. He crossed rivers, jungles, and grasslands. He had a bike that he rode ahead of the porters. One interesting story was that in a thick jungle, while riding under the moonlight, he ran into something. That something moved. Huh? It was an elephant's leg. The elephant shook his offended leg and trotted off. Titus pedaled furiously in the opposite direction and found the tree to climb. Well, the elephant notified his herd, and soon he found himself surrounded by elephants. He did find another taller tree and spent that night well above them in safety. He made it to the Ubangi River, used a hollowed-out log canoe, and got to Zongo on the border with Central African Republic. He crossed that border and headed north all the way to Sudan, Cameroon, and to Lake Chad. The traveling was tough, and the heat and humidity was awful, as well as dealing with the mosquitoes. And in Chad and Sudan, it was desert. Titus suffered numerous bouts of malaria, often lying sick for days on end. During one battle with malaria, he was unconscious for days before ultimately recovering. After 6 months on the journey, he arrived at Libengi in Congo, a few hundred miles from his ultimate destination. It was at Libengi that a letter from the Free Church Missions Board was received. It had been 7 months en route. The letter stated that he was officially accepted to represent the Free Church and would have their support to start a mission work. He purchased supplies and headed to where the Ngbaka tribe was. Like a magnetic pull, it drew him on. Very few white men had been to Karawa, besides some Belgian traders and the tax collectors. And fewer still had been seen on a contraption the Africans explained by drawing two circles in the sand with a line between them and said that the circles would spin. They'd never seen a bicycle. His journey to Karawa had taken about a year, covering 10,000 miles, and he'd worn out four bicycles in the process. Outside the government post, he wanted to set up his work. He connected with an unlikely character named Niengo. He was a local outlaw, wanted by the Belgians. He had 18 wives, each with her own hut. Titus befriended Niengo, and Niengo kicked out one of his many wives from her hut for Titus to move into. Niengo was known as a cannibal, cooking up children and men regularly. Though a brutal man, wanted by the Belgian authorities, a better provider and protector to Titus could not have been asked for. He applied with the government to get property at Karawa, but the Free Church Mission wasn't an entity recognized by the government. He was then allowed to register as a farmer so he could get a small plot of 1 hectare, which is about 2.5 acres, to live on. His total request was for 98 acres to open the mission station. He built a one-room house out of mud and sticks with a grass roof. Once built, he organized the first church service to celebrate. As he was preparing his sermon for his inaugural service, he heard murmurs, which turned to yells, and then to shrieks. He looked out of the window and saw a full-on battle. Knives and spears flashed, and men were stabbed and wounded, screaming. Titus grabbed a large club and started swinging it, yelling for them to stop until the group separated. Little did he know that the two villages he'd invited to church were warring clans. Each had thought they were the honored and only guests, and finding the other there was more than enough reason for a fight. Half a dozen were so badly wounded they couldn't move, so he treated their wounds as best he could.
My first service became a healing service.
Fortunately, none of them died. Months of waiting to get approved to start his construction projects continued. He got terribly sick numerous times, usually from malaria. Yet, he didn't lose hope. And he was still on a borrowed hectare, living in a grass hut. Yet his vision was there. He wrote the Free Church headquarters.
The spot is beautifully located. We will build a school and a church with big openings for air and light. We need many more missionaries. We must have branch stations at Kala and Tandala and near Bonzeville. We need 50 missionaries at once and another 100 in the near future.
No doubt the board groaned with smiles of condescension upon reading his letter. Yet today, the church can only marvel at his vision. Nothing was impossible with the God he served. It was a source of lifetime wonder to him that not everyone could see beyond the sensible or reach beyond the probable. That was Titus Johnson. He continued to wait months, hoping to secure the official status of the Free Church of America as a bona fide mission organization by the Belgian government. Then he got news in May 1924 that the first party of missionaries would be leaving for Congo. Reverend and Mrs. Henry Tweed, Miss Esther London, and Miss Molly Hansen, a nurse. Several months of travel later, Titus went to the Lisala River port about 190 miles to the south to meet them and help with the trip to Karawa. The journey to Karawa with the newbies was fraught with all sorts of problems, delays, and adventure. And it could be told in an entire podcast episode. But suffice it to say, they'd left Minneapolis on March 12, 1924, and arrived at Karawa on July 31, 1924. 4 months and 19 days it had taken. Remember, he still didn't have official status, so there was no housing for the new folks. Fortunately, a local Portuguese merchant offered temporary housing. They continued to push for official recognition, yet lost letters, insufficient information, and delays dragged the process on. They were allowed to build another hut on the hectare of, quote, farmer, unquote, property. Titus was finally going to return to the States for furlough, when on May 4, 1925, the official letter from the Home Mission Board arrived, recognizing the mission as an entity. The work could officially start. The new group had waited 9 months. Titus then changed his plans and returned to Karawa. He wanted to get to work. A second group of missionaries arrived in October, pushing the total missionary count to 11. These included Reverend and Mrs. Lloyd Johnson, Reverend and Mrs. Paul Rosell, Miss Helen Forsberg, and Reverend Arthur Skoglund. They applied for 2 mission stations to be established, Karawa and Tandala, about 90 miles to the west. Later, they requested permission to open up the station called Kala, up near Libengi on the Ubangi River. The group held their first official missionary conference November 6, 1925. Their first order of business was to change the name from the Swedish American Mission to the Evangelical Mission of the Ubangi, or in French, Mission Évangélique de l'Ubangi, or the acronym M-E-U. They wanted to de-emphasize being foreign and be more generic as a denomination. Then the official approval from the Belgian government arrived, allowing them to open Karawa and Tandala mission stations. I found 3 dates in 3 different documents as to this approval date. November 4th, December 2nd, and December 4th. So I can't be certain as to the actual date. But I lean to the November 4th date, as 2 days later they held a meeting to change the name, and one document said they started clearing the land on December 4th. Regardless, they were approved to begin their mission work, finally. So after considerable prayer, they drew lots to see who would go where. The Lloyd Johnsons and Helen Forsberg would go to Tandala, and then eventually they'd figure out how to handle Kala once that was approved. They started clearing the land immediately at Karawa, and Titus and Lloyd Johnson beelined it on their bikes to Tandala to start clearing the land for setting up the mission station there. A short time later, Titus Johnson went to Leopoldville to take a course in sleeping sickness, then returned to the States and then to Sweden to recuperate. He was burned out, tired, and depressed, so to his home in Sweden he went for some time. He then went to Belgium to secure a visa to return to the U.S. and there took a course in tropical medicine. And in November 1926, he returned to Chicago. The Rosells and Miss Forsberg joined the Lloyd Johnson family at Tondala in early 1926. Then, on March 5, 1926, their second child, Daniel Lloyd Johnson, was born. All seemed fine initially in the first few months of little Daniel's life. He was becoming a part of the family and being enjoyed by his older brother and parents. But slowly, he started getting sick and weak. Esther, his mom, describes him thusly.
Our little Daniel, about 2 1/2 months old now, was getting sweeter and sweeter with his bright smile when we would come and talk to him as he lay in his bed. But already he was beginning to suffer symptoms of dysentery, which was to claim his life. I had contracted dysentery the day he was born. I sent for Molly Hansen, our only RN in the mission, and of course there was no doctor. She was stationed at Carowa, and in 2 or 3 days she arrived. I sat up on the side of the bed, and she sat down beside me with little Daniel in her arms. All night long we sat there, taking turns holding him. Sometimes he would stop breathing, but when we gently shook him, he would breathe again. But the night wore on. So at 8 o'clock in the morning, when he finally drew his last breath, I could from my heart say, "Thank you, Lord, for receiving him into your loving arms." For I knew the tender shepherd could and would care for him like I had not been able to do.
Paul Rosell wrote in his book, Bread Upon the Waters, the final moments of Daniel's life.
Towards dawn on June 8th, he suddenly opened his eyes, reached out his little hands, and with an expression something like awe, his soul was carried away to be with the Lord.
He was buried some distance from the house. Lloyd Johnson found in Montgomery Ward's varnished wooden tool chest that they used for the casket. They had some sheer pink material from Belgium, and after placing some padding in the bottom, they lined the casket for little Daniel. A pillow and some flowers were added. As they prepared for the service, it started to rain, and it continued to rain. Then it stopped, and the sun came out. They held the service, buried the casket, at which point the rain started up again. A rose bush was later planted by the grave. Later, Paul Rosell made a marker with an inscription on it for the gravesite. Little Daniel was 3 months and 3 days old. It was June 8, 1926. The second saint was now in glory. Rest in peace, little Daniel Johnson.
Precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalms 116:15.
Upon Titus's return to the U.S. in November 1926, his former church welcomed him. He had a million stories and spoke in public settings, churches, and private settings about his work, Congo, the mission, and the vision. He shared the reports of the work and the great need for supplies, materials, and people to work in the Ubangi region. He was energized talking about the work, the mission, and the incredible need. However, the mission board questioned some of his financial decisions. He had not been fully paid his salary due to low funds in the U.S., and then with the new missionaries arriving and the ongoing needs for construction, supplies, and so on, the accounting wasn't as good as it should have been, per the mission board. Titus, as always, had approached his pioneering journey as a just-get-the-job-done kind of guy. His fellow missionaries on the field understood his approach and how he made things happen, but apparently the home board didn't quite see it that way. To that end, similar to how he'd wanted more independence to get things done and pursue the huge work in Africa with the Africa Inland Mission, now he was butting heads with the Free Church Board as regards to vision and funds. And asking for money was not his favorite activity. So always in need of funds and dealing with the accountability and bureaucracy of the mission board was frustrated, him being a just-get-it-done kind of a guy that he was. It was during this time that his childhood dream of becoming a doctor came to the surface. He was still mourning the death of Bertha, his fiancée, and digesting his initial years in Congo and the progress made and the vision of where to go. He was also pursuing U.S. citizenship, so at this time of contemplation and rethinking everything, he decided to pursue becoming a medical missionary doctor. His decision to pursue his medical studies was met with resistance and was an issue with the board, further causing angst for him. He began attending Wheaton College and started a church called the Wheaton Gospel Tabernacle. He became their pastor, all while attending medical school in Chicago. For what it's worth, the church was later renamed the Wheaton Evangelical Free Church, and many notable pastors followed him as pastor there, one being none other than Billy Graham. The official paperwork from the Belgian government for the Colle station was approved on July 7, 1926. Plans began immediately to start the work of establishing the mission station. A month later, on August 7, 1926, David Tweed and Paul Rozelle arrived at Colle after a four-day trip from Tondela. They hired 177 men to clear the thick jungle area at the top of the hill overlooking the river about 300 feet down. They built a two-room grass hut. The jungle was very thick, and trying to get one's bearings in the tall trees and vines and vegetation was a challenge. Making a dent in this thick jungle to create a clearing was very difficult. After much effort, they got some area cleared and built a few mud houses. Driver ants were notorious for invading the homes, especially at night, and were so bad that even with trying to steer the columns of ants with fire and torches, it was to no avail. This constant battle was exhausting. To let you know how dangerous driver ants can be, they march in columns with tens of thousands moving from one place to another. If they go into a chicken coop, they can pick a chicken clean down to nothing but bones and feathers in a matter of 20 minutes. After weeks of this, the missionaries were led to spend a day fasting and prayer for the ants to not invade through the homes. God answered their prayers, and from that night forward, the ants marched occasionally, but not through the houses. Isaac Palendo, one of the first Congolese evangelists, was part of this prayer meeting. Seeing God's hand in this issue propelled him to ongoing evangelism as a major force within the Congolese communities. Times were tough, though, as at Christmas 1926, the missionaries at Colle literally had no food. They had no money, and the local priest had spread lies to the villagers to not sell them anything. On top of that, the porters refused to go to Tondela to get supplies. So they spent time in prayer with six of the villagers that Christmas Eve, seeking God's help for basic sustenance. Christmas morning, they finished off the remaining crumbs they had and prepared to spend the day with empty stomachs. Suddenly, some porters arrived, carrying a wild pig they'd killed. This was going to be a feast. Merry Christmas indeed. A full stomach was the best gift they could have received. The work at Colle continued, and the school and church grew. January 1927 saw the first permanent building completed. However, being in an area of thick jungle, leopards were prevalent for hunting the chickens and goats and livestock of the Congolese. Also, leopards were extremely bold and would often kill humans, even in broad daylight. In 1941, leopards were causing issues, and one night, Martha Larson's chickens sounded a bit unsettled. That morning, they found the leopard spoor and prints and just feathers, meaning her chickens had been Mr. Leopard's dinner. She engaged some Congolese men to help her make a trap, and over time successfully caught and killed five leopards that had been wreaking havoc on the villagers and their animals. A year and a half later, Martha Larson went to Coquitville to study tropical medicine. When she was certified, she returned to Colle in 1943 and opened a dispensary. She not only kept the dispensary open, but made trips to the surrounding villages to carry out her duties for the government as agent sanitaire, or health agent. She tested the people for sleeping sickness and a number of other diseases in addition to treating yaws and other ailments. Quite a lady. These pioneering missionaries were tough. I've asked John Aiken, a retired missionary pastor that lived at Colle in the early 1970s, to share his memories of the station.
Colle had mostly brick buildings that have been done by the missionaries, the people that were Akala originally had been builders in the States. And so they were pretty smart guys and knew how to do all of that. They did a good job. And I imagine that those buildings are still standing today. The Akala Church was built later on. The first church, I think it was mud block, but then they put a brick church up first with a grass roof, and then they put a steel roof on it.
He explains the school and dispensary adjacent to the station.
Yes, the dispensary and the school were away from the mission station. They were down beyond the smaller village that was next to the mission station, so that's where that was located. It was not right up at the mission station itself.
Though there was a huge river at the base of the hill, John describes the domestic water source.
There was no water source for the Akala station per se. The water came from a spring that was in the side of a hill, and we would start a gasoline motor and pump that water up to, we had about a half a dozen barrels that were sitting on a rack out farther away from the main house. By the garage was where it was, and that's how we got our water. And then we, of course, boiled all of our water at that time, no matter what.
John remembers Akala fondly, as it was his family's home during their first term on the mission field. One memory of a Congolese sticks with him to this day.
I remember meeting a fellow that was so crippled that he had to shuffle along. He had wooden blocks that he used with his hands, and he dragged himself along with his hands and on his knees. And he would go out to the villages on the Sundays. We would usually take trips out to the villages on Sundays, and he would go out there and testify for the Lord. So that was a big impression on me.
Our family lived there for 2 years in the early 1970s. We shared a duplex with Hilda Stenstevold. Some of the stories about Hilda involved the night watchman waking her up, saying that a cobra was in the chicken coop. The watchman was too scared to enter. So Hilda grabbed a machete and went into the coop with a flashlight and killed the snake. Another time, a leopard was terrorizing the village and station at night, so she went out and shot it. I remember visiting her in San Diego in the mid-1980s, and she still had the leopard skin. That lady was fearless. One fun memory I have is from 1973. The Faulkners invited many of the Free Church families to come to Akala over Christmas vacation. This was the dry season, so the river level had dropped significantly, revealing huge sandbars out in the middle of the Ubangi River. The dads and boys took dugout canoes and all our camping supplies across the river to a huge sandbar that was over a mile long. There were probably 25 of us. We had fun swimming, fishing, and just doing guy stuff. It was hot and there was no shade, but it was quite a fun trip. The moms and girls stayed at the mission station and did whatever girls do, drank coffee and talked. I don't know. We boys and dads were having too much fun on the sandbar. I do remember Rachel Olson handing everyone a salt pill when we got back to the mission station after our camping adventure. The 1973 event was the first of many annual overnight campouts on the sandbar. Another interesting thing about Akala was the prevalence of pygmies. They are nomadic people and would live in the forest nearby for a while, then move away to hunt and gather food in the forest. There would be 6 to 12 in a group, and they'd build temporary houses that were only 3 to 4 feet in height out of leaves. They had almost no possessions, and most didn't even own clothes. Unfortunately, they were treated poorly by the villagers and discriminated against, so usually kept to themselves. Often, they'd come to our house and sell us honey they'd gotten from a beehive out in the jungle. Another benefit of Akala? Being on the river. That meant fish. The prized fish was the Nile perch that were often caught in the river that we would buy. It was an excellent white meat that was so delicious. There were other fish and often freshwater eel that we bought from the fishermen, but Nile perch was the bomb. Kala was the third station established, and thanks to the tenacity of the pioneers, it came to be known as a very effective mission station serving the tribe there, as well as being a beautiful spot to live in. Kala had the first secondary school for the whole Ubangi region. And the dispensary that was opened in the 1940s later became a hospital treating patients in the region. The second MEU conference was held in late 1926, and now three stations were up and running: Karawa, Tandala, and Kala, all about 90 miles apart. It was on November 9, 1926, that they planted the palm lane at Karawa. This consisted of planting palm trees on each side of the road entering into the station. The palm lane concept became a prevalent feature of many of the mission stations as they were built and developed. The palm trees are still there. It was Christmas Day 1926 that they held the first service in the new church building. People continued to join the church, and the message of the gospel was making an impact. There were no roads for vehicles yet, and often no gas for motorcycles. And so the, quote, roads, unquote, were footpaths cut through the forest or grasslands. Thus, interstation travel was a 3 to 5 day proposition, with porters carrying supplies tied to long poles on their shoulders, or riding a bike. One interesting comment I read in my research was that if there was good weather and a strong body, some of the men were known to have covered the 90 miles on a bike in 1 day. Amazing. Let me give a sidebar here for some perspective. This is my speaking as an avid mountain biker and road bike rider. I ride top-of-the-line mountain bikes that are carbon fiber, have front and rear suspension, wide knobby tubeless tires, amazing components, weigh about 25 pounds, and cost thousands of dollars. And they have 11 gears. I also ride a single-speed mountain bike regularly, meaning no gears. Yes, I'm a bit crazy. I've ridden numerous 100-mile road rides and numerous 50-mile mountain bike rides climbing thousands of feet in elevation, once on a single speed. And that was after training and with top-notch equipment, nutrition, and hydration. So I think I can speak with some authority here. I've driven the route numerous times from Karawa to Tandala, both in a truck and on a motorcycle on a road, not a windy footpath through the jungle. And I'm sure that even with my high-end 2023 all-carbon fiber mountain bike with gears, not a 1925 vintage bike, it would have been brutal to ride that distance in a day. It would have been really tough. Those early missionaries did it through footpaths in the jungle, riding heavy and clunky 40-pound steel-framed bikes with skinny tires, no suspension, lugging their supplies, and no gears. So the feat of strength that these pioneering men exhibited with their cycling trips is amazing and inspirational. Wow is all I can say about those guys. Building houses, schools, and a church were the main order of business at Karawa and Tandala. They were built of poles, mud, and with a grass roof. Housing was for the missionaries. Schools were to teach the people to read and train Congolese to go forth and evangelize their own people. The first group was sent out on March 1, 1928. Their first baptismal service was held at Tandala, where 12 young Christians were baptized. Later that month, the first baptisms were held at Karawa and Kala. 57 total structures were built at Karawa in the first 5.5 years since they'd gotten approval to proceed with creating a mission station. October 4, 1927, Reverend Theodore Wallen arrived, bringing the total field staff to 12. But only a few months later, a group returned for furlough, including the Rosells, due to medical reasons. The Kala station was now unstaffed. By the late 1920s, a few more missionaries joined, and many of the first-termers returned for the second term. Obviously, they were rested and more experienced and seasoned to continue the ongoing progression of the work and ministry. Field staff was now 14. By the early 1930s, many of the original buildings that had been constructed with poles, mud, and grass roofs were collapsing due to age, rain erosion, and termites. There was a safety risk for everyone, so they ordered brick machines from Leopoldville, and they arrived at Kala by river steamer. Thousands of bricks were pressed, two at a time, with these machines. Henry Tweed figured out how to make a kiln to fire the bricks so they dried hard as rocks. These bricks were made from the prevalent red clay in the area mixed with shells, which added calcium to the mixture. This formula provided a completely new building material that would provide permanence for decades. Henry Tweed had returned to Kala, and the workers started making bricks in earnest, and construction ensued. It was May 27, 1934, that the first brick dwelling was dedicated at Kala. That house was there in 1971 to 1973 when I lived at Kala, and was still there in good shape in 1989 when I last visited Kala. This new building material was fantastic. So in March 1933, they started construction using bricks at Karawa. Tandala was also cranking out thousands of bricks, and their first building was the church. This was dedicated on December 18, 1935, with over 700 people in attendance. Meanwhile, in 1931, the construction of buildings at Kala was going in full force, so much so that Henry Tweed fell seriously ill, necessitating his going all the way to Belgium for medical care. They thought he had cancer, but it was actually determined to be a stomach ulcer. His wife and two children and Molly Hansen stayed at Kala to continue with their work. Step into a time machine with me and transport yourself from 1931 to 1971. This was the year our family moved from Gemena to Kala. My dad was a teacher at the local Congolese secondary school there. We lived there 2 years. The John and Marilyn Aiken family, who lived in the first brick house constructed, and the Dave and Joyce Faulkner family were there. We shared half a duplex with Hilda Stenstevold, a nurse and amateur dentist. As you heard, Kala is located atop a hill overlooking a 300-foot drop almost straight down to the Ubangi River below. It's a beautiful mission station, forests and jungles all around, and only minimal grassland to speak of. As a young boy, hunting was a big part of my life. I only had a handmade slingshot to shoot at birds or lizards until that Christmas when I got a BB gun. So 9 years old, now with BB gun in hand, I was always on the lookout for something to shoot. There happened to be a very large fan palm tree in the middle of the station. The dead branches were lying against the trunk of that large tree, and daily I'd check the small space between the trunk and the dead branches, searching for a little lump. That little lump would be a bat, sleeping for the day. I'd try to aim straight up the tree trunk and hit the bat. I was only occasionally successful. Only a few feet away from the palm tree was a cement grave, raised up about 18 inches from the ground. I remember standing next to that grave, reading the headstone, and wondering about the person who was buried there. Stanley David Tweed. Died in 1931. He wasn't even 4 years old. What was his life like? How did he die? What did he look like? Who was this person? What was the mission station like 40 years prior? These thoughts have stuck with me my entire life. But let's go back to Kala in 1931. While Anna Tweed's husband David was in Belgium, hopefully getting the medical care he needed, one of her little boys got sick. Stanley David Tweed was sick with dysentery. With no doctors and no antibiotics, all they could do was keep the little boy comfortable as he declined. Then, on May 10, 1931, little Stanley passed away and was laid to rest. They buried him in a homemade coffin lined with a white wedding dress. Anna Tweed, the mother, later wrote,
"My hope was that one day he would re-arise from among the flowers where he used to play."
And the gravesite? It was a few feet from a palm tree. That same palm tree I used to look for bats in 40 years later. That grave had a simple message on it. His name, birthday, and date of passing. And the words, "Safe in the Arms of Jesus," were inscribed in the cement headstone. In 2023, someone sent me a book with a photo of it of the Henry Tweed family, and there was little Stanley. For over 50 years, I had wondered about that little boy who died at age 3 years, 7 months, and whose grave I'd spent so much time next to. Now I knew what he looked like. The third saint was now in glory. Rest in peace, little Stanley David Tweed. Oh, and you, Stanley, are on my list to look up when I join you in heaven. I do want to meet you.
Precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalms 116:15.
His father, Henry, didn't even know about his son's passing until his return from Belgium to Congo a few months later. How devastating to the family. Such was the price of mission service in the Congo. It is important to note that funds were very tight as the Great Depression was going full force in the United States during this time. So the field staff sacrificed to erect any building. In fact, Reverend Reinald Anderson had met Helen Forsberg and ended up getting married on February 25, 1930. A short time later, they had two daughters. Upon their return to Congo and living at Karawa, and being fully devoted to the mission effort, they chose to donate their money from their wedding gifts to build a brick dwelling. They worked, prayed, and hoped. One day, at morning prayers, Reverend Reinhold experienced an overwhelming joy as he read from the Word of God.
I go to prepare a place for you.
A few days later, he fell ill. A boil he had on his arm got infected, and he got blood poisoning. The nurses sat helplessly at his bedside, watching the red lines grow on his arm as he fought the losing battle. He was in tremendous agony. Shortly after midnight, he uttered,
Soko Boye,
translated from Lingala, so it is. He slipped into a coma, and at 1:15 a.m., September 5th, 1933, he passed away. And he indeed went to the place God had prepared for him. He was the first missionary adult to give his life for Christ and the gospel in the Ubangi. Reinald Anderson was the fourth saint to enter into glory. Rest in peace, Reinald Anderson.
Precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalms 116:15.
After his passing, Mrs. Anderson, now a widow, with two little girls, continued on with the work, spreading the word to people from village to village. What courage and dedication. One of the girls, Alice, later married Ron Myers, and they served in Congo for many years in pastoral and leadership roles. Meanwhile, during the past years, Titus Johnson worked towards becoming a doctor and concluded his medical training in July 1934. A year later, he was ready to return to Congo and was now a U.S. citizen. But he was in debt, and though the mission board accepted him to return to Congo, due to the Great Depression, funds were very limited. So unfortunately, there wasn't any support to start a medical program that was so desperately needed. So he hung up his shingle and opened a medical practice in Chicago. Arthur Skoglund had gone to Congo for the first time in 1925. During his first term on the field, Arthur was very busy with helping at Karawa, Tandala, and Kala. Besides numerous evangelism trips to villages and other duties, he often filled in with helping build homes and churches and other buildings on the various mission stations. It was March 19, 1929, that a new missionary nurse arrived on the field, named Naomi Olson. A romance ensued, and on November 24, 1930, Arthur and Naomi had a civil service wedding ceremony at Gemena, and then on December 1st celebrated a Christian wedding in the Tandala Church. Lloyd Johnson officiated. They served together for several more years and then, at the end of their term, welcomed their daughter, Grace Joan Skoglund. They returned to the States in 1935 for furlough. When they came back to Congo in June 1936, they went to Kala to begin their next term of service. Incidentally, the Skoglunds brought the first car with them to the mission. It was a mere 10 days after arriving at Kala that Grace became sick. Within a matter of a few hours, little Grace Joan Skoglund died. One source noted that she, quote, got sick in the morning with pernicious malaria and by midnight had passed away, unquote. It was June 16, 1936. She was just 18 months old. I read numerous documents about this incident, and none had any more details as to the cause of her sickness, her care, or the funeral. She was buried, presumably the next day, next to the church at Kala. The fifth saint was now in glory. Rest in peace, little Grace Joan Skoglund.
Precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalms 116:15.
I remember her grave as I lived at Kala for 2 years in the early 1970s. Little Grace Joan Skoglund's grave was the first to be placed near the church. It would be 25 years later that she would be joined with another child who would be buried adjacent to her. No doubt the tragedy of losing their daughter was very painful for Arthur and Naomi. In one book I read, the author even noted the juxtaposition of the joy of the Skoglunds having the first car in the region, coupled with the tragic loss of little Grace Joan. Yet, Arthur and Naomi pressed forward with the work, relying on the promise that one day there would be a reunion with her on Resurrection Day. In conclusion of this first episode of the series, we took the listener from the vision of Titus Johnson through his 10,000-mile journey to get to Carowa to the years of delays to be recognized as a bona fide organization, to getting Belgian government approval, to the beginning of infrastructure and staffing to begin the work. Three stations were established by this time, and the mission was looking at expansion. Also, there were the people that gave their lives in the process. Bertha Peterson, Titus Johnson's fiancée, in 1921 from dysentery. Little Daniel Lloyd Johnson in 1926 from dysentery. Stanley David Tweed in 1931 from dysentery. Reinald Anderson in 1933 from blood poisoning. And Grace Joan Skoglund from malaria. The loss of one spouse or fiancé or child was heart-wrenching for every family on the field. No doubt they questioned the cost of serving in Congo to be part of the pioneering mission's effort. But all these saints will be remembered and rewarded and rejoined with their families one day. I read numerous books and articles and logs to put this story together. Thanks to Dr. Tom Cairns and Dr. Tim Wester for forwarding considerable materials from the archives, including books, articles, and letters to help with this story. The list of document acknowledgments is very long, so I will do so at the conclusion of the final episode. The main resources for this episode, however, were the biography of the life and work of Titus Johnson as written by Sig Westberg and Francis Mason and the book titled Deep Tracks in Africa. Also the book Bread Upon the Waters by Paul Rozelle. Having these written documented resources is great for purposes of preserving history, and their efforts are to be recognized. Thanks also to John Aiken for his experience at Kala. Also to the many folks who provided voiceovers for the characters in this episode to help bring the stories to life. In episode 2 of this 7-part series, we will present the period of 1936 to 1947 of our mission work in the northwest corner of Congo. You will hear about the discovery of a lake that became a vacation spot, the identification and procurement of several more mission stations, and the stories of the unfortunate loss of several children and adults that passed away. I will cite a passage from a book about the incredible challenge that people had with disease and lack of medical care so you can appreciate what the people were up against. Thank you for listening, and I hope you continue the journey with me and listen to the next episode of Trials and Triumphs in Congo, a 100-year mission journey.
So that concludes this episode.
I hope you enjoyed it and will listen again. Other podcasts and blog articles on a variety of topics can be found at congokid.net. In addition, Congo Kid's life stories are also posted on Apple iTunes, Google Podcast, and Spotify. I'm Jeff Eales, a.k.a. Congo Kid, your humble host. Until next time, I will send you off with a farewell in Lingala. Baninga nangai, tikalamalamu. My friends, stay well.